Good afternoon. It's Friday, the 30th of November 2018, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host today, Mike Robinson, myself, Brian Gerrish, and we're delighted to be joined by David Scott. David, of course, reporting from north of the border with Northern Exposure. I think we've got an incredible news today, Mike. It just seems to be unfolding piece by piece. But first of all, Ukraine.
Yeah, we'll start off with Ukraine because things ramping up there significantly with Pavel Poroshenko tweeting out yesterday that Russian men between 16 and 60 are now barred from travelling to Ukraine. This, of course, is because things are escalating, simmering along quite nicely as far as the British establishment perhaps would like at the moment. He has tweeted this out, saying that this has been taken in order to prevent Russians from forming private armies fighting on Ukrainian soil. And in the meantime, then, he has done this, as reported by Associated Press this morning. Ukraine has sent intelligence officers to search the home of the Father Superior of Kiev's largest and oldest monastery, according to Associated Press here, which is part of the Russian Orthodox Church. So Ihor Guskov, chief of staff of the SBU intelligence agency, told reporters that its officers are searching the home of Father Pavlo, who leads this monastery in Kiev. We'll come on to hatred at the end of the programme if we manage to get through everything in time. But apparently he is suspected of inciting hatred. So there you go. In the meantime, the G20 summit starts. It starts today. And of course, Donald Trump was expected to meet with Vladimir Putin. And maybe if that meeting had taken place, this escalation might have been held back a little bit, Brian. But apparently this is not going to happen now because Putin is persona non grata as far as Trump is concerned. He tweeted out this last night that based on the fact that ships and sailors have been refused, returned to Ukraine, he will not be meeting with President Vladimir Putin. I look forward to a meaningful summit again as soon as the situation is resolved. So because the ships and the personnel have not yet been returned to Ukraine, he's refusing to meet with President Putin. I wonder, has this got something to do with it then? Because, of course, as reported yesterday in various midstream outlets, Mr. Cohen has admitted to lying to Congress. This is part of the Mueller investigation. So this report here from The Guardian saying that Trump's oldest son and other associates of the president may be at greater risk of prosecution after Robert Mueller, the special counsel, showed he's willing to criminally charge people for lying to Congress. He managed to obtain a guilty plea from Michael Cohen, one of Trump's closest advisors for more than a decade, who admitted giving untrue account to Congress about the Trump Organization's efforts to develop a tower in Moscow in 2016. So a bit of a coincidence that the day before, a couple of days before Trump is going to meet Putin, that this should happen. I just wonder whether that has had an impact or has encouraged Donald Trump to refuse to meet. In the meantime, he can still meet President Xi, and there are other meetings going on. So Putin will meet President Abe from Japan. Because, of course, Russia and Japan never actually signed any kind of peace treaty following the end of the Second World War. And this discussion is still continuing, and Putin saying that he's hoping that they can accelerate the process to reaching a peace agreement between Russia and Japan. So I don't know what you make of that, Brian, but clearly lots going on with involving this escalation in Ukraine.
It's just incredible. And let's remember, of course, it is all happening under what we describe as the smokescreen of Brexit. So the whole public focus, Brexit, 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 while we've got these really serious events going on in Eastern Europe. And let's just follow up on our story about what BBC Media Action has been up to. So just a quick recap from what we spoke about on Monday. So we're pointing out the BBC Media Action. Now, this BBC charity sits alongside the BBC. It boasts that it's able to share offices and pension funds, but it's completely independent. But it's transforming lives through media around the world. And we got interested because, of course, they are there working inside the Ukraine. And this was BBC Media Action boasting working with the television channel NTU, delivering capacity training, doing all sorts of good work, which we'll come on to in a moment. And we also said, interesting that they're being funded by the UK's Foreign and Commonwealth Office and the US State Department, as charities are, Mike, of course. So we challenged them yesterday. We sent an email saying to their press officer, I believe I've spelled her name correctly, please can you tell me how much BBC Media Action was paid by the Foreign and Commonwealth Office and the US State Department to set up the BBC Media Action operation in Ukraine, and in particular to run the five BACSIV project 2004-16, and how much money BBC Media Action has received from the Foreign and Commonwealth Office and the US State Department for your operations in Ukraine for the period 2016 to date. So that was a pretty easy email. They suggested I sent it. The result has been a wall of silence. I've tried four calls today. They're not even answering their telephone today. I decided to go looking at our stock to see what I could find. And I found this very interesting exchange with BBC Media Action back in 2014, where they started to tell me about the fact they were working in 17 countries in Eastern Europe, the Middle East and North Africa, and that they were drawing on BBC expertise and editorial values to support free and fair media. You're happy so far, Mark?
Absolutely, like, yeah.
And to build the capacity of journalists to cover key social, economic and political issues, including EU policy. That's quite an interesting statement, that the BBC's charity is there to help install EU policy, but it's impartial and it's independent in these countries and regions.
But is this a surprise? Aren't the BBC doing that in Britain?
They're absolutely doing it in Britain, Mike. But what Ukraine gives us, what Syria gives us, what Libya gives us, is the potential of the BBC to be ramping up hatred and helping to cause breakdown in the country.
Yeah.
Now, that's happening in UK, but we haven't yet got the violence on the street. We will say that is being worked on by the British deep state. So we just underline that. There it is, to build the capacity of journalists to cover key social, economic and political issues, including EU policy. And the other one down here, it says we've not been covering recent events in Ukraine. Now, this is dated 2014. So let's put those together. We've not been covering the recent events in Ukraine. But here's the BBC website for 2018, saying they've been doing a lot of work in Ukraine, including working now with their TV channel, script development, program design, all going in there and all funded by the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. But when did that program start? Well, according to the BBC Media Actions box there, it started in 2014.
Maybe you gave them the idea.
Well, maybe I gave them the idea. Anyway, since BBC Media Action wouldn't speak to me, I decided to contact a journalist that I knew was working in Ukraine. Let's have a look at him, John Fisher.
Jonah Fisher.
Jonah Fisher. It's a very strange name, isn't it? A little bit biblical. But there he is. So I decided just to post a question to him. But very quickly, within minutes, I was blocked. Now, I'm sure our viewers and listeners would like to know what I asked him. So luckily, I have a capture of what I sent. He says, send me great stories. So I said, I'd got a great story for you, Jonah. At BBC Media Action was paid by at Foreign Office and US State Department money to build the capacity of journalists to cover key social, economic and political issues, including EU policy, includes NTU. So the BBC is creating its own pro-UK and UK news from Ukraine. Comment, blocked. blocked within minutes. Just to make sure that what we're saying is correct, I'd retweeted it via the Brian Gerrish account. So there is that tweet deleted within minutes. So let's have a look at what this journalist has been doing in the Ukraine.
Martial law has just been introduced in parts of Ukraine. Are you worried?
Yes, we are worried. We have grown up children, boys. We are worried we might have a war.
Of course, we are worried about the regions where the martial law is in place. It's quieter here in Kiev, but there the tension is very high. Without a doubt, we are worried.
Why do you think the president declared martial law in Ukraine?
My view is we are supposed to have elections soon. If martial law is implemented, the elections might be postponed indefinitely.
And our president will be here forever. This is just to create more panic, which we already have more than enough of.
Your president says there's a real possibility of Russia invading Ukraine. Does that worry you?
I'm not worried. I don't believe in it. I don't think it will happen right now.
The president has talked about the possibility of a Russian invasion. How real do you think that threat is?
The only thing Putin wants is an invasion. He cannot accept the fact that Ukraine is an independent state now. A lot of people think...
So there we are. We've got a BBC journalist. We don't know whether he's part of that gravy train from the British Foreign and Commonwealth Office, or possibly he's received money from the State Department. The BBC doesn't want to answer these questions. But that's a leading question, isn't it? Are you worried about being invaded by the Russians? So one of the locals, we'll take at face value, says we've got enough tension in the country. We don't need more tension. And we've got a BBC journalist going around asking the leading question about the government there, asking leading questions about Russian invasions. And what's in the back of my mind is the lady from BBC Media Action who said we were there on the ground in Syria working with the people who were beginning to move against Assad. So this is the same BBC charity. Are they a charity? What are they doing? This is part of another video that Mr. Jonah did. How do we know who this woman is? Is she genuine, or is she a BBC trained journalist who's been asked to do a bit of filming? We have no way of knowing. But if you dare to ask the BBC what they're up to, you're blocked. So this man was clearly terrified of the question, Mike.
Well, of course, if you'd asked that question about whether she is a trained journalist or whether she's a member of the public or what she is on any other day, then we might not have known the answer. But of course, if we invite David Scott to comment at this point, David, it was only yesterday that the news broke with pretty lame excuses from the BBC on Twitter that they were using apparently a professional actress to comment on Brexit, for example. So it's totally within scope that they may be using actors to comment on other issues as well.
Well, yes, and more we look at the BBC and we wonder, what are we seeing here? What actually is this? Because often it's not what it appears. The strange thing about the actor that was on Newsnight wasn't just she was wearing a dog collar and seemed to be a clergy, but I don't think it's any sort of mainstream form of clergy. So that was all. So she's sort of presenting herself to be something she's not. She wasn't introduced as an actor or an actress. She was introduced as a member of the clergy, because that's what the clothes said. And then what did she say? She said, basically, that our wise overlords understand all of these complex things much better than we, the public, do. We should just sit back and trust them to get on with it and not ask awkward questions. That was the line. A very strange line. I've never heard anyone else in Britain come away with that sort of approach.
Well, is Jonah Fisher one of these wise overlords? Because you, I believe, also tried to ask the same question that Brian asked about Ukraine.
Yeah, it didn't go well. I said to Jonah Fisher, why did you block independent media journalist Brian Geddes when he asked this question? And I posted the question on the tweet. I said, I'm sure that David Ellis, Veterans for Britain, Julia Hartley Brewer, David Coburn, George Galloway and Jacob Rees-Mogg would like to know the answer. I don't know if that group would be happy to be lumped together, but that's the first names that came to mind. And 3 minutes later, he blocked me as well. So he seems to be a little bit nervous about this.
I think he's very nervous, and I think the BBC is exceptionally nervous because we have seen a pattern of the BBC operating in these very volatile areas. They say they're helping to transform their communities. Well, what has the BBC done for Britain? EastEnders. That's what the Eastern Europeans are going to get with the violence on the end of it. So if you're listening from the eastern part of Europe, it's time you really understood what the British Broadcasting Corporation is. £3.74 billion of propaganda machine.
Right, let's move on then. The Sun has this headline today, Surrender, as in surrender, as EUR. Theresa May's Brexit deal is a threat to the West security and will surrender our forces to EU control, say senior spooks. So who are the senior spooks that they're talking about? Well, Sir Richard Dearlove and Major General Julian Thompson have written this letter along with Sir Rocco Fort. Lord Trimble, who's the former Ulster Unionist leader, Martin Howe, QC from Lawyers from Britain, and a top investor, according to The Sun, Sir Paul Marshall. So what have they said? They're basically saying that Theresa May's Brexit deal will surrender UK's defence forces to EU control, senior intelligence chiefs claim. This is how it's worded in the article. They say it will also compromise vital British intelligence, threatening Western security. And they say that backed by former Chancellor Nigel Lawson, they warn it puts at risk the fundamental Anglosphere alliances, specifically the vital Five Eyes alliance, and therefore threatens Western security. And the letter says the deal surrenders Britain's national security by subordinating UK defence forces to military EU control and compromising UK intelligence capabilities. No risks are greater than the withdrawal agreement's terms of surrender. The people voted to take back control of her sovereignty, not for a colonial status. Mrs. May has broken trust with the British people, and she has lost the trust of so many of her ministers. Okay, so that's a statement from some pretty senior people about EU military unification. And in parallel then yesterday, this was released. It's entitled Protecting Europe, Meeting the EU's Military Level of Ambition in the Context of Britain. And it was published by the International Institute for Strategic Studies and the German Council on Foreign Relations jointly. And they say the ability of the European Union to act in defence today and in the future is an important reference point in the debate about EU strategic autonomy in the context of Brexit. The EU has itself a military level of ambition. Under the heading of the Common Security and Defence Policy, EU member states want to be able to conduct a range of military operations. The IISS and GAP have developed policy compliance scenarios to assess where possible capability shortfalls lie. Our findings benchmark existing and future EU member state capabilities against the force requirements the EU level of ambition generates. So let's have a look and see what their key points were. So the first one was this. Of the IISS DGAP scenarios, only the rescue and evacuation operation and the support to humanitarian assistance operation did not generate any capability shortfalls. In other words, all the others did. If the United Kingdom is omitted, the humanitarian assistance operation faces a shortfall in the naval domain. They go on to say the scenarios concerning peace enforcement, conflict prevention and stabilisation in support to capacity building would all create significant capability shortfalls, even when the current 28 EU member states are considered. Without the UK, the EU27 would face much greater shortfalls. Under these circumstances, a successful implementation of the operation is doubtful. It goes on. If the peace enforcement scenario is combined with the rescue and evacuation scenario, notable capability shortfalls emerge across all domains for the EU28. Without the UK contribution, additional shortfalls would arise in the land and naval domain with regards to enablers. They say it is if up to seven of the smaller operations are combined, which corresponds to the EU level of ambition, the EU28 are out of its depth. There are extensive capability gaps across all domains, and often less than one third of the force requirement would be met. Removing the UK from the picture renders a bad situation much worse. And then it says improving in the meantime, and improvements in the maritime and air domains across the EU28 are likely by 2030. However, these will not close the identified capability shortfalls, and aging equipment will increasingly become a problem. And finally, this one, as of 2018, EU strategic autonomy is limited to the lower end of the operational spectrum. Brexit will make it even more necessary to find constructive combination of European partnerships and transatlantic engagement. So in a nutshell then, Brian, what this is quite clearly saying is that if Theresa May, as she has said time and time again, is committing to maintaining European security and defence, then she cannot make that commitment without Britain involving itself in EU military unification, according to this report from two pretty senior think tanks. This backs up what the senior military people are saying in this letter to the Sun, and it backs up what we've been saying for about several years, actually.
Completely, but the key thing is that all of the procedures, all of the organisations for this EU military structure is already in place. It's not something that's being planned for the future. It is already in place and it encompasses everything. It's all three services, Army, Navy, Air Force. It is nuclear, so it involves Britain and France's nuclear deterrent. It involves research and development, procurement, defence industry. And of course, Theresa May's already committed British taxpayers' money to come into the EU unified military structure, and that money will go ultimately into the new EU treasury. So all this is in place, and as David Ellis says, 48 hours, the EU can flick a switch and all this becomes operational. So you ramp up the crisis in Ukraine, BBC doing a great job with its charity, and then what can that be used for? That's switching on this vast EU military structure.
Okay, now, final advertisement for Democracy in Chains. This is AV 9.1, Alternative View 9.1, taking place in the Crown Plaza Hotel in London on Sunday, this coming Sunday. Tickets available at alternativeview.co.uk. There are still a few tickets left for that. Do get along to that if you possibly can. Now, Integrity Initiative. Now, this is the leak that was leaked by Anonymous the other day, and seems to be suggesting that there's some kind of massive disinformation campaign run via the Institute for Statecraft. If you remember the statement, the original statement said the Integrity Initiative was set up in autumn 2015 by the Institute for Statecraft in cooperation with the Free University of Brussels to bring to the attention of politicians, policymakers, opinion leaders and other interested parties the threat posed by Russia to democratic institutions in the United Kingdom, across Europe and North America. The Integrity Initiative aims to unite people who understand the threat in order to provide coordinated Western response to Russian disinformation and other elements of hybrid warfare. So this is the organisation, the Institute for Statecraft. This is their website. Go and have a look at it if you're interested. But we were interested in the sort of legal entity itself and how they were set up and so on. So here is the record for Companies House for the Institute for Statecraft. And if we just have a look here, they seem to have a registered office address of the Gateside Mills, Gateside Fife in Scotland. So that's all good. David, you know this area pretty well. But just before we come on to that, we'll mention that there's this. These are the directors here. I'm not even, maybe David, you could explain to me how to pronounce the first guy's name, since it's a Scottish name.
Well, it's not, but I understand it's Daniel or Danny Laffaidney.
Okay, Laffaidney, yes.
So the name's here, Daniel Laffaidney, and then you have Donnelly, and then you have Oliver James McTiernan. Okay, right, so remember those names.
These are key names. Now, the other interesting thing is that they have a dormant company, also registered at Companies House, called the Council on Foreign Relations. And this is not the US-based think tank. It seems to be something else. As I say, it's a dormant company. It apparently doesn't trade at this point. There's some speculation that perhaps what they're intending to do, or what they were intending to do in the future, was to use this to pay people through, and therefore on people's bank statements it would appear to be coming from the Council of Foreign Relations. But we have no particular reason to know what this this company was set up for. And again, it has the same registered office address, Gateside Mills, Gateside 5. Well, it seems to have more or less the same directors, David.
Yes. Again, you've got Daniel Lafayette, you've got Christopher Nigel Donnelly, and you've got another Lafayette, John Lewis. He's a financier. And again, Oliver James McTiernan. So, yes, the same team. Gateside Mills, once again.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Well, let's move on, because the last week when I looked at this, they had not published any financial statement for this year, or for up until 2017. This is the latest financial statement. And the first thing to note here is that we have a registered charity number and a registered company number, and these both begin with SC, because of course the company and the charity are registered in Scotland. And if we look on the next page of the financial statement, we find that their registered office is labelled as Gateside Mills, Gateside Cooper 5. So again, there can be no doubt about this. This is not a case of you know, just being a bit tardy in their filing of keeping their records up to date, because this is a brand new document that's been posted on the company's house website in the last month or so. So anyway, we know that it's a registered charity. So here's the Scottish Charity Regulator website and the charity details. And again, we find the same address there. No problem. But we have a bit of a problem with this address, David.
Well, Gateside is a very small town, and it's not very far from where I live. So I thought I'd go and see if I could have a word with them and have a look at their office and see what the setup was like. It didn't go well, because this is it.
So this building is derelict.
It's certainly empty. This is the back of it. You see, there's some demolition being going on. Derelict, semi-derelict, certainly empty, not in use at the moment. Nobody there, all locked up in darkness. And that is Gateside Mills. That is where the Council on Foreign Relations and the Institute for Statecraft have their registered office. It was a little bit of a surprise.
So this is very strange. I wonder what the consequences are for companies that are putting false information on documents that they submit to Companies House and to the charity regulator, for that matter.
And to the charities, yes. I spoke to a very nice lady who was operating a dressmaking business from an adjoining property, and she remembered Daddy, but she hadn't seen him for around a decade. So he used to operate a business from that building around 10 years ago, but he hasn't been back since.
Okay, so this is all very strange. Well, let's have a look at Daniel Lafayette. What can you tell us about him?
Well, here we go. Co-founder and director of the Institute for Statecraft, he has wide experience of international affairs, working with UK and foreign governments. Senior Associate Fellow, Advanced Research and Assessment Group at the Defence Academy of the UK. Specialised in the defence and implementation of capacity building projects for high level governance of the security sector in European and Middle Eastern countries. So all of the hotspots, and in supporting development of counter radicalisation programmes for at-risk ethnic communities in the UK. So if it's a problem, Danny's your man. He's got it all here. He has military service, legal background. He's a Scottish lawyer, so that should reassure everybody. And an entrepreneur and an understanding of the importance of the link between business and national security. Okay. Senior member of St Anthony's College, University of Oxford, member of the Law Society of Scotland, holds a degree in Scots Law from the University of Aberdeen. So there we go.
I mean, we've mentioned Mr. Donnelly on Monday's programme, but just briefly.
Well, briefly, he's a special advisor to NATO. He's been advising four Secretary Generals of NATO, including Lord Robertson. He's now director of the Institute of Statecraft, having left NATO some decade ago. And he is ex-Army, Royal Military Academy, Sandhurst, and very much an establishment and long established player in very high level military and international diplomacy matters. So I went looking for these names, because you got these names and they're not names you associate with Gateside and abandoned mills and Gateside and Fife. So I went looking for the names, and it's amazing what you find, because, well, they cropped up at a conference. The two of them were both at a conference. This was a conference. This is the current one being advertised, the Hezliya conference. Now, this is known as the Bilderberg of the Levant. It's the Israeli establishment and military industrial complex having a long and detailed meeting about their plans. And both of these gentlemen, Danny Lafidney and Chris Donnelly, were at the 2007 conference. They were very lucky to be there because they could hear Newt Gingrich give a keynote address. And there's more, because 2007 they worked for different organisations. At that point, they on the list, Chris Donnelly is a senior fellow of the Defence Academy of the United Kingdom. And Danny Lafidney is with a company called BICOM.
And what's that, David?
And BICOM is the British Israel Communications and Research Centre. They have a lovely website on which you can see our current Defence Secretary sitting on top of a tank, as Defence Secretaries are apt to do. Now, this is the British military establishment and the Israeli military establishment in a close huddle.
Okay, so where does that leave us then? Oliver McTernan is the other director.
Oliver McTernan, yes, this is the other name that came up, and they're linked in other interesting ways as well. Here you see an organisation called Forward Thinking. Now, Oliver McTernan's part of this. In fact, he's a co-founder and director, but you see here Chris Donnelly is also part of it. And they're interested in basically solving the Middle East crisis, right? So they, when you read their website, you hear Tony Blair's voice in your head. I don't know if there's any link between the two, but it's certainly very much the same area. It's Middle East, it's peace, it's sorting out problems. And again, when you follow the names, you get other interesting places. You get Ditchley. Now, this is a very interesting organisation. It has a grand, as you see, a very grand palatial residence here in England, and there is other organisations in Canada and in the United States, and they have extremely high-level meetings under Chatham House rules to discuss the problems of the world. And these gentlemen attended the one on Turkey, the road to EU membership. Now, remember, there's a lot of concern about Turkey, but from a geopolitical point of view, that means moving the borders of the EU right up to the Black Sea. That means controlling the Bosporus. It means cutting Russia off from the Mediterranean. There's a big prize there. And the other one is the future of NATO. So you see they're talking about expanding the EU, and what do we do about NATO? Now, following more information on Oliver James McTernan, I got a little bit of surprise, because he's an Irish priest, right? And here's his details. He was born in 1947 in July. It's the same date, by the way, as July 1947 as on the company's house information. He was ordained and is an Irish priest. And now he's a priest of the Westminster Diocese. So that would be handy. So he's in the very heart of power, but he's looking after spiritual matters there. And he's also the founder of a trust fund, which is linked to both London and Moscow. So a very interesting, almost spooky character. And he's available on video as well. And some of the things he talks about, this is still here from the video, but he's talking about if countries, this is concerning the Syria crisis, if countries pursue their interests instead of what he regards as principle, then countries become the problem. So he's got quite radical views about sovereignty as well. So we've started to unpick this, and it's just an absolute network, a cluster of organizations and people, and they're connected at the very highest level, right? You very quickly, one or two steps from here, you get prime ministers, you get presidents, you get the very highest level. So this is the deep state in operation, and it's out there to change the narrative, to change how people perceive Russia, how people perceive risk, and it's all to do with the EU, it's to do with NATO, it's to do with the Ukraine, and it's to do with the Middle East.
So do we say that the building is a bit spooky then? Is that what we're saying?
The building is spooky, yes. I would have to say that it's all those dark windows, yes, spooky would be right.
And David, BICOM, if I remember correctly, BICOM, we've got some interesting people connected with that I can recall. We've got Paolo Zabludovitz, who was the gentleman who personally backed with money David Cameron's campaign. Zabludovitz also gave a lot of money, well over £100,000, might have been several hundred thousand pounds to the Tory party. We've got Liam Fox involved with it, of course, who's the man now back at the middle of the so-called trade deals. Michael Gove's also connected with them. So even if we just go as far as BICOM, we're into some very, very high-level, powerful people who've got a lot of money to fund the very politicians who seem to be causing all the trouble at the moment.
Yes, and if you go to Ditchley and look at the governors and honorary governors, you see the entire establishment.
Okay, well, look, let's move on then, David, to Barnardo's. What's this story all about? The headline in the Mail is, Boy 12 was raped by Barnardo's Children's Home Care after petrifying grooming campaign, but charity allowed attacker to stay on.
Yes, this is extremely worrying. This man suffered terribly as a small boy in the care of Barnardo's. And he went in 2001 to Lothian Borders Police, and they said he would investigate, and then nothing happened. And he was kind of hung on, and he was told that, you know, things are progressing, we are looking into it, for 10 years. If you can imagine the additional suffering involved in that. And then it seemed that the whole thing had stalled. And then when he started to push, the police re-established the investigation. They got the guy, they arrested and charged the man, but when it went to the Crown Office and Procurator Fiscal Service, it was decided that it was insufficient corroboration, and there was no prosecution, which he was distraught about. Now, you see here the power of a little bit of Twitter, because this story broke and there was nothing from Barnardo's. There wasn't any comment at all. So Brian and I got on to Barnardo Scotland and Martin Crew, who is their chief executive, and we asked them to make a comment. And last night at 9:45, Martin said there would be a statement. And here is the statement from Barnardo Scotland. We deeply regret what happened to Mr. Steele and for the anguish he has endured. Barnardo's did receive a disclosure from Killian Steele in 2001, with allegations of abuse against a former employee. As is the case now and as it was then, we take any and every case of disclosure seriously. Mr. Steele's allegation was reported immediately to the police, and Barnardo's cooperated fully with the police investigation. Now, no sign of many important things there. And on Twitter, there was a comment from Janine Rennie, who is Chief Executive of Wellbeing Scotland, an organisation I'm associated with, and she said that in such cases where there's significant harm, the resulting impact on the person abused, particularly where they should have been safe, there's loss of trust and there is fear. As in the recent football case, an apology rather than regret would be one step forward, followed by redress. And she's quite right. There is neither apology nor is there redress, nor is there any detail as to what actually happened here, nor is there any thorough examination of what went wrong, nor is there any public examination of how it might be fixed. There are many things which are not covered by the Barnardo statement.
Okay, well, sorry.
What we're coming to hear is Police Scotland, and it's sort of like the end of the news during the 1970s. On a lighter side, Police Scotland is now becoming the lighter side. Now, they've had several goes at this. They're trying to get an anti-hate campaign. And the first post that you see here, Be Greater Than a Hater, was their first go at it. And people were laughing all around the world. People were making videos in America about how ridiculous this was. So that didn't go so well. They then decided to try the Dear Bigots campaign, and that actually had the Police Scotland campaign reported to Police Scotland as a hate incident, which it was, because Police Scotland defined a hate incident as any incident that is not a criminal offence, but something which is perceived by the victim or by any other person to be motivated by hate or prejudice. So it's entirely subjective. So someone reported it, that they perceived it in this way. And then Police Scotland turned around and said, well, our rules don't apply to us. We've looked into our motivation, and we were entirely pure in heart, and therefore it's not a hate incident, even though that excuse wouldn't work for any of the rest of us. So that didn't go well. So we need a well-focused and well carefully thought out and managed media campaign to get this off and running. Okay, here it is. The all-seeing eye, right? The big, spooky, all-seeing eye watching you. It suggests, right, both Masonic connections, which for Police Scotland is maybe not the way to go, and also the obvious Big Brother imagery. And, so this is how Police Scotland have decided to play it. They are going for... We are the state. We are Big Brother. We are watching you. We are watching everything you think. Because remember, we're talking about hate crime. You're not allowed to say unpleasant things. Essentially, you're not allowed to think unpleasant things. So we are watching your emotions, and we're watching you very closely. So I love the all-seeing eye imagery, because, well, we have seen it before, haven't we? Once or twice. Well done, Police Scotland. That's going to be very effective. But I tweeted this out, and back came comments again that showed that this is not just from Scotland, this is worldwide, and it's coming from America, because although Scotland's a testing ground, none of the ideas are generated here. So what we see next is a poster from the States. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will also harm me. So words are now being criminalized, right? Non-criminal action has been turned into criminal action. And is saying, report hate speech, see something, act, right? And this is for the Institute of Peace. And if you follow that line through, you get some very interesting organizations. And then there's also a Dutch and EU-based organization that defines hate speech as hate speech is intentional or unintentional public discriminatory or defamatory statements. So you can be guilty without even knowing it. And then finally, we have this little video. Have we time to play that?
Sorry, I think we lost me there for a second. Sorry, David. This video suggesting that any criticism of migration via the UN's Global Compact for Migration extends to become hate speech itself. So this is Marcel de Graaf. So is this coming from the UN itself, or is it coming through the UN from national governments?
No, this is top down. This is from the UN. The national governments have been asked to sign up to this as a non-binding commitment. Okay, you can understand that, and then pass it into national law. So that's where we're going. So to be opposed to what the government is doing will increasingly be criminalised. This is extremely worrying.
Yes.
And we also have to remember, of course, that Peter Sutherland, who was the UN's advisor on migration matters, who's now deceased, but he said very clearly that migration was needed to break down the homogeneity, the basic structure of European nation states, and we needed more of it. So he said, we need more of it. You dare criticise it, you are going to be done for hate speech. That is obviously a deliberate and calculated policy, David.
Yes, absolutely. The dissent is not going to be tolerated, and we're going to use the coercive wing of the state, the policing role, to make sure that your ideas cannot be voiced.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's the end of today's news. Thank you very much for joining us. I think we put out some very important material today. We encourage our audience to follow up, do the research yourself, follow through the links. And if you're as unhappy as we are with what we are finding going on under the surface in UK, then there are those Twitter pages to get on. There's emails to be sent. There's phone calls to be made. It is difficult. It is challenging to make the first call. But if you stay calm and polite, you will be amazed at how fearful individuals connected to this sort of material become, how defensive. So BBC, vast amount of money, billions of pounds, but you send them one email and you can feel them dissolving. Mm-hmm. So don't sit at home and worry. It's the action conquers fear. Thanks very much for joining us. Bye-bye.
All right.